set something in place that people can predict for several years in the future and budget for.
The Senate proposes putting a cap on state spending. From Alaska Public Media, this is Statewide News on Alaska News Nightly for Thursday, March 15th. Good evening, I'm Ann Hillman. Also tonight, in a predictable fit of passion, Congressman Young defends resource development.
We've got a secretary who understands public lands and where the wealth of this nation comes from. It does not come from BS.
The stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
ACPE's education loan refinance can save you money and give you just one bill for all your private, state, and federal loans. The Alaska Refinance Loan offers Alaska residents a 4.95% interest rate with no fees. You choose between a 5, 10, or 15-year plan. Go to acpe.alaska.gov/radio or call 1-800-441-2962. This message sponsored by Alaska Commission on Post-Secondary Education.
The Alaska Senate is considering a bill intended to limit how much the state government spends. When oil prices soared in 2008, so did Alaska's state spending. Soldotna Republican Senator Peter Michicki says that if the state had the limit he supports back then, it would have spent less, and it would have another $15 billion in savings.
It's not too late to make the changes in the future that we need to make to ensure that we don't put ourselves in the same position that we're in today.
Alaska does have a limit on spending in its state constitution, but the amount allowed under the constitutional limit has grown so much that the state is nowhere near it. Under the bill, spending on state government departments couldn't be more than $4.1 billion in the fiscal year starting next year. That's a little more than the amount that Governor Bill Walker proposed for the year starting this July. The limit would grow based on inflation. Anchorage Republican Senator Natasha von Imhoff says the spending cap would provide stability.
We can set something in place that people can predict for several years in the future and budget for. And I think that just provides confidence, it provides predictability, and that is what we need for a future economic growth and investment.
Michelle Hale is the former Division of Water Director at the Alaska Department of Environmental Conservation. She opposes the bill and says applying the limit could force cuts to state services.
Spending caps and arbitrary cuts are blunt tools. They're blind. If we say we have to cut by another $100 million this year and turn that over to the agencies to do, basically the legislature is abrogating its responsibility to the state and the people of the state of Alaska.
The Senate Finance Committee discussed the bill today and plans to consider it again tomorrow. Low oil prices have been punishing Alaska's budget managers for 3 years. Now, the legislature is eyeing the permanent fund to pay for the state's bills. But it's a complicated concept, one that carries a very real risk of failure. From Alaska's Energy Desk, Rasha McChesney has more.
There's an old brown church with a steeple on top, just across the street from the state capitol. But it isn't a church anymore. Now it's where David Teal works.
Is this your office?
Mm-hmm.
It is packed with houseplants.
And bugs.
Unless you've been living under a rock, you know that Alaska's budget is a mess. After 3 years of fighting it off, the legislature seems to have finally agreed to tap into the state's permanent fund. I wanted to talk to Teal because he runs the Legislative Finance Division, and breaking into the state's biggest piggy bank carries a lot of political and financial risk. But it turns out that maybe lawmakers have more control over the outcome than they thought. Before we get to that, let's get a few things straight. Alaska's permanent fund, at last count, is worth about $66 billion. It's basically made up of two parts. There's the main account. It's protected by the Constitution, so lawmakers can put money in it, but they can't take money out of it. The second part is called the earnings reserve. No surprises here. This is the account that holds the earnings. That's the money the permanent fund makes on its investments, and it can be spent. When legislators talk about spending the permanent fund, they mean the earnings reserve. Got it? Good. Back to Teal. He says the earnings reserve is fundamentally different than other reserves the state has used to pay its bills.
It can vanish without being spent.
Okay, that's kind of dramatic. but he means there's volatility in that account because of the way that it's invested. Sometimes that's a good thing. Those investments have doubled the size of the fund in the last decade, adding billions to that piggy bank. But big risks can also bring big losses. It's hard for lawmakers to plan for those big losses because in the entire history of the permanent fund, there has been just one year where its investments lost more than they made. That was 2009. Remember that global recession? It triggered some of the worst years the U.S. stock market has ever had. In Alaska, Thiel said the earnings reserve was drained. Remember, that's the one lawmakers want to use now.
And there was some concern right up until the final month of the fiscal year that there was no money for dividends.
That's right. The earnings reserve is the account that pays PFDs every year, too. But this is not a story about dividends. What you should know is that when that crash took a big bite out of the permanent fund, when its managers were faced with the prospect of losses in both accounts, they chose to protect the main one. They transferred money into it from the earnings reserve to keep that main account from taking a loss. 10 years later, the state's in a recession again. But some things are different. This time, there is enough cash to pay dividends, but the politics have changed. Now, the governor, along with the legislature, has been capping PFDs. This leaves millions in that earnings reserve for lawmakers to potentially spend. They haven't yet, but it is hugely controversial. And one current senator said, it's illegal. So he sued. That case made it all the way to the state Supreme Court last year. It's pretty widely known as the Willikowski decision, which is kind of interesting because when you talk to Senator Bill Willikowski, it's definitely not a decision that he would have made.
Unfortunately, it didn't turn out the way we had hoped.
That's right. Willikowski lost that case. And that court ruling made it clear that every penny that comes out of that earnings reserve account, no matter what it's used for, has to be appropriated by the legislature. Remember back in 2009 when the permanent fund lost more money than it made? Well, its managers didn't ask permission to use that earnings account as a buffer. They just did it. And if that crash were to happen again, they couldn't do it that way again because Willikowski lost that case. When I asked Willikowski about that change, he was surprised.
That wasn't something that we focused on.
He was focused on dividends. He says the broader implications of that ruling weren't clear. But putting aside the irony of a lawsuit aimed at giving the legislature less control over the permanent fund having the literal opposite effect, Willikowski says this is a big deal. He sees it as a power shift between the legislature and the managers of the permanent fund. He says if lawmakers start relying on the earnings reserve to pay the bills, he doesn't trust that they'll transfer money out of it to protect an account they can't touch. David Thiel sees it differently. He says now that losses are spread out between both accounts, it seems less likely that the earnings reserve will run out of cash. And maybe that's a good thing if the state's going to rely on it to pay the bills. From Alaska's Energy Desk, I'm Rasha McChesney in Juneau.
A Fairbanks grand jury has indicted 13 inmates from the Fairbanks Correctional Center on charges of rioting and criminal mischief related to an August 17th riot at the facility. The inmates took over a part of the jail for about an hour and a half before surrendering when two tactical police units released tear gas. KUAC's Tim Ellis reports.
When the 13 inmates took over the A wing of Fairbanks Correctional Center on August 17th, the jail was locked down and Wilbur Street, which leads to the facility, was closed off. Alaska State Troopers and Fairbanks Police helped corrections staff secure the area, and both troopers and city police called in tactical response units. They ordered the inmates to surrender, and the prisoners responded by breaking windows and pouring slippery soap on the floors in anticipation of officers charging in. But after police fired a volley of tear gas, the inmates surrendered. Some of the 13 indicted inmates have lengthy criminal records that include convictions for violent offenses and whose cases have now been reopened as a result of their roles in the riot. They include 23-year-old Tevin Alonza Davis of Fairbanks, who's charged with two counts each of first and second degree murder in connection with shootings at a Southside nightclub that left one man dead and another wounded in 2016. And 24-year-old Dimitri James Rice of Fairbanks, who's charged with kidnapping, assault, and armed robbery related to a home invasion last Christmas in which one man was pistol whipped and another held at gunpoint. Fairbanks District Attorney Greg Olson was traveling today and unavailable to talk about the case. State Department of Corrections officials didn't respond to queries by deadline, and Alaska State Troopers and Fairbanks Police declined to comment. In Fairbanks, I'm Tim Ellis.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, YK Delta tribes team up to carve a massive ice path on the Kuskokwim River.
And they proved it can be done safely in a wild, long, lonely stretch of the river, too.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
Did you know while exposed to secondhand smoke, every breath you take can damage your heart? Cells lining blood vessels become swollen and inflamed. Plaque builds narrowing blood vessels, and clots can form, robbing the heart of oxygen. Exposure to secondhand smoke increases your heart disease risk by up to 30%. It's your heart protected. This message sponsored by Alaska's Tobacco Quitline, 1-800-QUIT-NOW.
A proposal to issue bonds to pay off about $900 million in tax credit debt to oil and gas companies hasn't gained much traction in the legislature. Governor Bill Walker included it in his budget in December. Since then, the bill has had no hearings in the House and just one in mid-February in the Senate. Walker says he's still hopeful that it will make it through this session.
Well, I actually have heard some fairly positive things about that from various legislators. That once they understand it, there's some confusion initially, and so we spent some time with them, and I think that there's some interest in that.
Most of the credits are owed under a now-defunct cashable credit program that was designed to entice new companies to explore and produce oil and gas in the state. The bill would allow companies to opt in to a program that would pay credits now, but at a discount. The cost of borrowing the bonds would be built into the discounted rate, so the state would not lose money. Anchorage Republican Senator Natasha Von Imhoff says there are some things that make the bill attractive. Right now, the state makes a minimum payment on its balance on the balance it owes. Last year, it was about $73 million. This year, it jumped to over $200 million.
That wildly variable payment, it's hard to predict and hard to budget for. A bond will create, theoretically, a locked-in payment.
Pat Galvin is the chief operating officer at Great Bear Petroleum, a private oil exploration company.
The worst thing for the state is if the companies that did this work basically fall apart and go bankrupt and disappear, then you won't get other companies willing to come up because we'll just see a bunch of dead companies lying around.
Galvin says the outstanding credit debt has already done a lot of damage to the state's reputation, but he sees this proposal as one that could help fix that problem. Around the U.S. Capitol, Alaska Congressman Don Young has a reputation for fierceness, and he did nothing to dispel that notoriety at a hearing today. Alaska Public Media Washington correspondent Liz Ruskin says Democrats seem to get under his skin.
Interior Secretary Ryan Zinke came to the House Resources Committee to defend his budget. And the Democrats on the committee came to do battle. They questioned Zinke's ethics, his spending, his stewardship of public lands. Representative Jared Huffman of California told Zinke phrases related to climate change appear in the department's budget documents just 31 times, mostly to describe programs Interior wants to slash.
This is a budget that prioritizes the profit that oil and gas and coal companies can dig, drill, and otherwise wring out of our public lands with no consideration of future generations.
By the time it was Young's turn to speak, he professed to be enjoying the Democrats' show.
It's such a pleasure to hear them squeal and squall on the other side after they stuck it to us all those years with Sally Jewell. I enjoy every moment of it.
Jewell was President Obama's last Secretary of the Interior, and Young seemed to grow madder by the second, even as he was praising her replacement.
We've got a secretary who understands public lands and where the wealth of this nation comes from. It does not come from BS. It comes from the land.
Young stared across the dais toward Huffman and the other Democrats.
And you want your social programs and et cetera, but you don't want to pay for it. The only way you can pay for it is utilization of our resources God gave us and what we should be able to develop in the right way.
Young moved on to ask an Alaska-specific question of Secretary Zinke. But it was only seconds after he'd been blasting the Democrats, and he had trouble with the details.
The BLM and their studies of the eastern, I call it the interior, came down with
the proposal. The Eastern Interior Resource Management Plan. Young thinks it's too restrictive.
Are you reviewing that? You know, I hope you know what I'm talking about.
Zinke did. He says Interior has no plan to scrap the document, but they're looking into it. Reporting from Washington, I'm Liz Ruskin.
Wrangell has declared a water emergency. City officials say the southeast community has about 1 month of supply left. So they're asking residents to cut back on use. Those conservation measures and more rainfall could solve the problem. KSTK's June Loeffler has this report.
The city says it will aggressively monitor and strictly enforce water restrictions for residents. These mandates include no outside water usage, fixing plumbing leaks, and reducing everyday consumption. Lisa Von Bargen is the city manager.
Obviously, nobody's really watering anything outside yet because it's still too cold, but there's going to be the urge to want to wash your cars. Please refrain from doing that. Any washing of decks or driveways or paved surfaces or things like that.
Residents who don't comply will get a verbal and written warning. Further violations could bring a $500 fine. Wrangell does not have a water metering system.
We're not going out there with a hammer and handing people a citation immediately. We're going to make sure that the community understands why we're doing this and what needs to be done. But please, we need to make sure that there isn't abuse and isn't egregious use of water in the community. So
the city says it will survey and fix its own system leaks.
We believe that there are losses in the water system. We just don't know where they are, and that needs to get done.
The city issued a red alert. This comes less than 3 weeks after it announced a lesser yellow alert. The water shortage is twofold. There isn't enough raw water because the island hasn't gotten much rainfall. And the water treatment plant isn't cutting it. Through its filtration process, it's losing hundreds of thousands of gallons a week.
Every time we do filter cleanings, we're dumping approximately 150,000 gallons of water, which is a ridiculous loss because there's no way to recoup that. That can be anywhere from between 2 and 4 times a week.
The city says it has plans to retain half of that lost water through more maintenance. The plant was installed in 1999. Since then, it has required way more maintenance than anticipated. And in the past few years, it has struggled to meet the town's needs. It is also working with the Alaska Department of Environmental Conservation to address the issue. The city is working towards replacing its plant. In Wrangell, I'm June Loeffler.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by
ConocoPhillips, investing and exploring on the North Slope and creating economic opportunities for Alaskans. ConocoPhillips, unlocking Alaska's energy resources. The University of Alaska Anchorage is investing in Alaska by equipping students with the knowledge and tools for academic success. These students will go on to be the doctors, nurses, teachers, engineers, and artists of Alaska who shape the future of the state by bringing new solutions, inventions, and ideas to the table. Amazing stories are being written every day at UAA. More information at uaa.alaska.edu/admissions. This message sponsored by UAA.
A dog has died at a checkpoint along the Iditarod Trail. The sled dog belonged to Kotzebue musher Catherine Keith and was being treated by veterinarians for signs of pneumonia, according to a release from the Iditarod. The 5-year-old male died just after midnight today at the Koyuk checkpoint, roughly 20 hours after Keith dropped him and continued on with her 8 remaining dogs. Typically, when a dog is dropped over health concerns, they are quickly brought to air hubs like Unalakleet and McGrath before traveling back to Anchorage. But bad weather in Koyak and along the Bering Sea coast has made air travel inconsistent the last several days. This is the first dog death during this year's Iditarod and takes place against mounting pressure from animal rights groups over the dog's welfare in the long-distance race. They say a rising tide lifts all boats, but what about a rising data set? The Alaska Longline Fishermen's Association is nearing completion of a map of the seafloor to help local fishermen catch more efficiently. The map was made possible through a network of small boat fishermen that have spent the past decade gathering data. KCAW's Emily Kwong reports.
This is a great image of how good our data is getting.
Stephen Rhodes is exploring open ocean with the click of a mouse. He's showing a group of fellow fishermen the latest version of a map detailing the rise and fall of the ocean floor. Sitka Sound is presented in vivid detail.
To the west of that is state data, and to the east of that is our user data. And we're getting pretty close on the shape of the bottom.
Otherwise known as bathymetry. Fishermen have long used soundings to visualize in their mind what the seafloor looks like and target species known to gather near certain topographical features. With these maps, Rhodes is able to home in on those locations more precisely. He toggles with a slider, which paints the map with colors to represent different depths.
Most of the time when I'm fishing, I use the discrete mode because my brain gets stuck in fish in the green, that's where they're at.
The fishermen in the room look on. They aren't just the future users of this product. They were its data scientists, too, pinging the seafloor with echo sounders for years while out fishing. At the end of every season, the Fisheries Conservation Network sent their data to the Alaska Longline Fishermen's Association. And like pieces of a puzzle, Alpha reconciled the local data set with federal and state maps, working in concert with a software company called NobleTech Time Zero. Alpha's executive director, Linda Bankin, said the result is one of the most complex bathymetric databases on the eastern side of the Gulf of Alaska.
It's 140 million data points that have been contributed. It's been a lot of years getting to this point, and we're really excited about the level of detail that we have now and the quality of the maps.
And now, Alpha is ready to share these maps with the fishermen who made them. The XYZ file can run on a computer of about $1,000 in value that supports the NobleTech software. Fishermen are invited to contribute to and clean up the data set while out on the water. And the goal of all of this is to make Sitka's small boat fleet more competitive and efficient. Bankin says the project was born out of a desire to help fishermen target the fish they want and avoid the fish they don't.
So, for example, halibut tend to be in hard bottom areas rather than sandy or muddy bottom. But if you get into hard bottom areas that have too many pinnacles, for example, then you get too many rockfish.
In addition to reducing bycatch, Bankin hopes the maps will help fishermen avoid areas that host sensitive species like corals and sponge and protect their gear. Fishermen can start downloading the database on March 15th. All participating fishermen will sign user agreements pledging not to share this data outside of the network. Reporting in Sitka, I'm Emily Kwong.
The Kuskokwim River now has its longest ice road ever, in a year when people thought there may not be any ice road at all. As of early March, the graded barked road stretched 200 miles from Bethel upstream to Crooked Creek. The project has involved almost a dozen tribes working together across months. KYUK's Anna Rose MacArthur talked with one of the crew members.
The day the Kuskokwim's longest ice road was completed was a reunion.
It was a good day, a lot of handshaking. a lot of backslapping.
Mark Leary with the native village of Napaimute was there. His crew heading upriver met with the crew from Crooked Creek heading downriver, led by Timmy Zakar.
I really wanted Timmy and his crew to tell the story to KYUK, but can't get a hold of them today. They're all out enjoying their road.
This winter, the road stretches across a section where it's never been, from Napaimute to Crooked Creek. Crooked Creek joined the project for the first time, adding the miles to make the longest Kuskokwim ice road ever. And it was done in the warmest winter on record.
And they proved it can be done safely in a wild, long, lonely stretch of the river, too.
This in a winter when road plowing started in mid-January, a month later than usual. People were surprised that it happened at all. Many open holes still perforate the ice, but the freezing and thawing has created a glassy surface easy for crews to plow. And equipment upgrades mean the crews aren't facing constant breakdowns like past winters. The newest plow truck is actually 25 years old and comes from Seattle's SeaTac Airport.
We gave it a name, Tumlista, the one who makes a trail.
For travelers along the lonely stretch of road below Crooked Creek, take caution. For 60 miles from Crooked Creek to Chawathbuluk, there's no cell phone service, and the snow quickly drifts. Further downriver, there are two areas marked with danger signs. One is 10 miles below Kalskag at Coffee's Bend, where the road winds between a cut bank and an open hole. The other area is below Tuluksak, where dark sand has blown across the ice.
And as soon as that sand gets exposed and the sun gets a little stronger, we may lose that area very quickly.
The road's social and economic benefits spread to all the villages it connects. Building the ice road provides employment during a time of year when seasonal work is hard to come by. It allows residents, businesses, and government agencies to avoid hefty plane tickets, and it gives the Kuskokwim a highway and a land far off the road system. In Bethel, I'm Anna Rose MacArthur.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org. Like us on Facebook at Alaska Public Media and follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Andrew Kitchenman and Rasha McChesney in Juneau, Liz Ruskin in Washington, D.C., Tim Ellis in Fairbanks, June Leffler in Wrangell, Zachariah Hughes in Nome, Emily Kwong in Sitka, and Anna Rose MacArthur in Bethel. Our audio engineer is Eric Bork, Wesley Early is our web editor, and I'm Ann Hillman. Have a lovely evening.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible in part by your local public radio station.
4 out of 5 Alaskans addicted to heroin started by using prescription opioids. Common opioids include hydrocodone, oxycodone, morphine, fentanyl, and codeine. Safely getting rid of unused opioid medications prevents anyone from taking them without permission, which could endanger them and lead to consequences with law enforcement. Find out more at opioids.alaska.gov. This message sponsored by the State of Alaska Department of Health and Social Services.
Never miss another episode of your favorite PBS primetime programs thanks to Afternoon Tea on Alaska Public Media TV. Every weekday, you can catch up on the drama of Masterpiece. Be amazed by our universe with Nature and Nova. Search for garage treasures on Antiques Roadshow and solve mysteries alongside our favorite detectives. Watch Afternoon Tea weekdays from 3 to 5 p.m. only on Alaska Public Media TV. One of the greatest honors for a public media station is delivering on its promise to provide quality programming and news you can trust to the communities it serves. What you hear on air is the result of a dedicated team working together to bring you the best. It's a privilege to be a part of your day. Thank you for listening, for your feedback, and for your support. This is Statewide News on Alaska Public Media.